Now you're kind of locked into wherever you're sitting. So, but if you want to just casually just kind of get up and come forward at some point, that's fine too. I'm here without Ruthie today. Sorry. She is up in Folsom area. We have some of our grandkids up there, and so periodically she makes sure that the grandmother thing happens, and she's up there. So I'm sorry if that's what you were hoping for. You know, that isn't going to happen. As we gather here, I mean, any Sunday that we gather, there are different things that we hopefully are all engaged in. One of those is we want to lift our voices in praise. We just did that. I mean, that's part of what we do. Another part of what we do is listening to the Lord and allowing Him to speak from His Word. Hopefully there's other types of interactions with other believers, and there's the encouraging types of ministries, and there's all sorts of things that happen as we focus our attention upon God on a Sunday morning. One of those things, hopefully, is part of your rhythm of your spiritual life, is coming on Sunday morning and inviting God to look deeply inside you and to partner with Him in prayer in looking inside ourselves and saying, where am I right now? And what do I need to do as far as course corrections? And what kinds of things do I need to adjust in my walk with Jesus? And that's part of what we do, because He is here, and we desire for Him to actually engage with us, not just on an intellectual level, not just on an emotional level, but to look deeply inside us. In addition to those times when we invite that, I believe there are times in our life on a rhythm where we need to stop and ask God to look more deeply in us, to do more of an expansive examination of ourselves before Him, and ask Him to give us insight into how to adjust our lives to come more in line with what He would have for us. And that's part of it is because we just, our lives kind of do this kind of thing where they kind of fade all over the place. We need to come back to center and come closer to Him and all those kinds of things. Sometimes that's by way of retreats, like we were talking, your youth are off on a retreat right now. That can be one of those times as youth, they will look deeply inside themselves. So the retreat coming up, see, that's one of those times again. You look deeply inside yourself and you make those course corrections. For me, one of those practices in my life of that more expansive examination takes place in January. It's the beginning of a year, and it just kind of naturally falls there. And I'll take that time to kind of look back over the last year's time and watch where my life has gone and be kind of hard on myself, you might say, to look and say, okay, where am I really? What needs to be adjusted? So I did this January. There were some things I looked inside myself and I was not happy with what I found. And it was, part of it was stuff that had been kind of building inside of me. As I kind of had walked through those last couple of months of the year, and I was becoming more and more aware of it. And so this kind of was to kind of settle down and say, okay, what's going on here? And a lot of it revolved around the idea of finding myself in places with groups of people and realizing that in the midst of those gatherings, which get heightened during the holiday season, Thanksgiving and Christmas type of things and all that stuff. I found that, and as I looked and was honest with myself on that my presence really had no spiritual value in those groups. That I was simply there. And it bothered me. I mean, it should bother me. It really bothered me. I was in those situations like most of us find ourselves in. I mean, all the way through that holiday time. I was with family at different times. I was with some of the community things that we do. I was with others that were artist groups and writers groups. And I can kind of go on all those different kinds of situations we find ourselves in. And realizing that, that Jesus resides in me. and that somehow wherever I am, it should be obvious that Jesus is present. Now, not obvious in a weird way, you know, where everybody kind of goes, whoa, you know, but that somehow his presence is there because he resides in me and I'm there. And as I look back at those, you know, all, I kind of went through all those deals and I was dramatically disappointed in myself. So with that, I made some decisions of how I would move forward. And I'll leave those to the end. Now, now, what I want to do, though, is take you into a text, you know, a portion of Scripture here that informed a lot of my decisions. And that was really the basis for where I made some of my decisions. And I know that for many of you here, this is not going to be a new text. I know the heart of your church. I know Josh. I know your leaders. That you probably revisited this a number of times. So I want to take you back there again and just kind of do my own walkthrough with you on it. It's in Colossians. So make your way there, whether it's in your paper Bible or you text yourself into it somehow, whatever, you know, whatever you got, get yourself there. Colossians chapter 4, verses 5 and 6. Here's what it says. It says, conduct yourselves with wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned as it were with salt, so that you may know how you should respond to each person. Now, as you look into this, it kind of breaks down into two halves. You know, you got each verse kind of carries a piece of this. The first verse has to do with the idea of making the gospel believable. The second one has to do with making the gospel accessible. And as I look at this and kind of burrow into this a bit more into verse 5 there, the first one kind of is this idea of earning the right to be heard. And if you look at kind of how it's, you know, the words that are used here, there's some interesting ways that it comes out. It says, conduct yourself with wisdom toward outsiders. Now, kind of look at that word first, outsiders. That there's a very obvious difference in spiritual language here between those who have entered into a relationship with Jesus and those who have not. Those who have become part of the redeemed and have experienced the forgiveness and the grace and the mercy and this new life that God brings to us. Those would be described perhaps as inside. That's one way to use that terminology. But those who have not, the Scripture refers to them as outsiders yet. They haven't entered into this relationship. They haven't discovered all this yet. They're still on the outside of this. And it says that in relation to those, that we are to act with wisdom. Now, let me give you a little bit of framework also for this outsider idea. I came across something back here, it was probably, I don't know, 6-8 years ago maybe, a study that was done. This is in a large church back in the Midwest. And they did this interaction with all the people in their church. And it wasn't just like a big survey thing, it was actually talking with them. And they asked them about all the different places, different environments they found themselves in. They called them worlds. How many worlds do you live in? It's kind of an interesting way to describe it. And that included every little different type of thing that you're in. Some place where it's a different group of people, and because of that, you kind of talk a little different. You've got maybe your own language, you know, within that group, or a different way of seeing things. And so it broke down in a whole bunch of ways. So it's not only work versus at home, but it was all the subsets of being at work. It was not only at church, but it's all the subsets of meeting with people at church. It's not only your family life, you know, relating to a spouse, but also relating to your kids in each one of those. And if they did this and they broke it down, they found that on average in their church, on average, the typical person in their church lived in 37 different worlds. Isn't that something? Now, some of you are thinking, let's see, 1, 2, 3. But what that did was it made the whole church aware of how pervasive they were. How many different places that God had, ready for this? How many different places God had called them into. Not just had ended up randomly there, but that God had called them into all these different worlds to be Jesus in the midst of those. To allow His presence to invade all of those. And that each one required kind of thinking of it a little differently. Because like I said, some of them have a completely different language. You know, like when you talk with little kids, it's a different language. Or whenever you get into kind of your close friends, you've got different ways you kind of buzz things versus, you know, other people that are more professional type of situations, whatever it is. But it called everyone into a different way of seeing the worlds they were in and realizing that most of those worlds are populated with outsiders, people who do not yet know the redemptive wonder of knowing Jesus. So as Paul writes to these believers here, he says to conduct yourselves with wisdom toward them. In other words, order your life in such a way that you've thought about it. You've actually, you know, it's not just randomly walking into these situations or casually stepping into, excuse me, but of consciously thinking about the fact that you were in the midst of them there and, understanding, kind of doing a little bit of a cultural exegesis, you know, kind of sorting it out and thinking it out in the midst of each of those, being aware of where you are. Conduct yourself with wisdom toward outsiders, ordering your life according to what you know about them. I go back over and over again in my own mind to some individuals that I met years ago. It was right after freedom came to those Soviet countries, and I was able to talk with a couple of people that came out of Romania, and the things they said stick with me to this day. One of those was that they talked about the idea that they were not given freedom to speak openly about Jesus. They could respond to people if they were asked, but they couldn't initiate any conversation. Now, although that was something imposed on them, it's kind of the way our culture works a bit here. It's a little harder to press, but it's much easier if someone asks you about something. And so what they said was that we had to live lives, and this is great, they said we had to think through a way of living lives that demanded an explanation. To live lives that demanded an explanation. Ever since, I've asked myself over and over again, does my life demand an explanation? Or can people look at my life and say, yeah, whatever, just like everybody else? Is there something about me, other than weirdness, that demands an explanation? Where people somehow have in their mind, what's going on there concerning how you relate to people or values in your life or where you choose to put your time or your money? I mean, all this kind of, is there something that makes them ask what's going on, that demands an explanation? Conduct yourself with wisdom toward outsiders, he says, making the most of the opportunity, not letting the opportunity get past you. The idea of, literally, it's redeeming the time, that you have this opportunity for a moment, and it's going to pass. And won't be there again. So, you know, making the most of this here. Being fully present in that moment and conscious of what's going on and the fact that you have a window, a space here that will be gone. Now, by way of an illustration here, because I have to bring this in, I would be negligent if I didn't. You know, we have a granddaughter. Some of you are going, what? Okay, we have 5 grandsons. We were very much used to the idea of little boys running around. And then, you know, a year and a half ago, we have our first granddaughter now. Woohoo! Lives just up here in Oakland, and so, you know, we're up there a lot. But every time we are, which last weekend we were up there again, and my wife keeps wanting to invent reasons why we need to go to Oakland. And she's just the cutest little girl. Man. But when we're with her, it's this idea that she kind of occupies the time. Now, not because she's saying, look at me, but she's the entire entertainment. You know, we're constantly aware of the fact that she is 18 months old and that won't last. And so you absorb this. You want to see every little thing she's doing and everything is cute and we laugh and all this, you know, all this. But you're very much aware that this is a moment here. And that same idea is what Paul is calling us to do in every situation. To be aware of the fact that this is, we're not just blowing through things here, but that this is a moment. There's a space of time where you're going to be able to relate to certain people in a certain way here, and it won't last. It'll be gone. And Paul says, you know, to approach it with wisdom, making the most of that opportunity, kind of bringing it out so you get the most you possibly can out of this. Fully present, conscious of what's going on, aware of those who are around you. Now you move to the next verse there, and it moves us from the idea of making it believable, living in the midst of it like this, you know, so that you are there, fully present, and making it accessible, bringing the gospel actually in connection with those people here. Notice how he says it here. He says, let your speech always be with grace, seasoned, as it were, with salt. So somehow it not only plays out in actions that we're doing, but it ultimately comes down to what we're saying. Because the gospel is communicated actually in words. It's the ideas and all that are communicated as we interact with people. And so he says, let your speech be with grace. Now that, not grace as in God's grace. It's gracious speech. So what does gracious conversation sound like? Well, for one thing, it's conversation that is not abusive, it's not adversarial, and it's not self-centered. That moves a lot off the table, right? It's not abusive. Hopefully none of you do abusive speech. It's also not adversarial. You're not picking fights with people. Not drawing the lines and saying, you're on this side and I'm on this side, you believe this, I believe this, and trying to somehow do this big battle type of thing here. It's not it. And it's not self-centered. The conversation is not simply about me. It's about these other people. And that we're interacting with them and we're drawing them into conversation. In fact, that's the idea that gracious conversation is interested in other people. Gracious conversation is inviting conversation. It draws them into conversation. It's this kind of thing where people want to talk with us. If you find people backing away out of the conversation, you probably don't have this going on. But gracious conversation draws people in. It's interested in them. It invites them to come closer. Let your speech be with grace, seasoned, as it were, with salt. Salt is one of those images in the scriptures that has to do with this idea of the savor of Jesus in us and the gospel itself. And so that imagery is there. But when it says seasoned with salt, it's talking about art form. I mean, it's easy to kind of back the truck up with salt and just dump it. Here's the gospel. Boom! Seasoning is an art form. In fact, the word that is used here for seasoning is the Greek word artouo. So it's like the way to remember it's an art form, literally even in the word itself. It's an art. It has to do with the word has to do with the idea of arranging things a certain way or of making something ready so that it's acceptable on the other side. One of the gifts that one of my daughters gave us for a Christmas gift was salt, but not just any salt. It's that finishing salt. I mean, you got—I know you guys—you got foodies in here. I was kind of unfamiliar with the finishing salt idea. You know what that is? It's not just the regular salt you throw into stuff, you know, and kind of get it so it's seasoned to a certain level. Finishing salt is what you see them do, like if you watch any of the food shows and stuff, or if you go to a really classy restaurant, and you see them kind of sprinkle this little salt on the top. They didn't get that out of the little $2 thing. Instead, it's a finely crafted salt that is sprinkled just a certain way on there that adds this punch to it. That makes it come alive. And I've learned the art not only of enjoying it, but I've learned the art of sprinkling it and making sure that everybody sees me do it. You know, so it's not just it's on there, but it's, you bring it out and say, that's me. Pretty cool, huh? And it's wonderful. It brings this wonderful taste. That's the idea. Seasoned, as it were, with salt, he says. Gracious conversation that invites people in. Seasoned with this finishing salt, you might say. So that, it says, you will know how to respond to each person. Notice how it's said there, that you can respond. In other words, your life is creating a credibility such that people want to know what in the world's going on. You're living a life that demands an explanation, that calls for it, that draws them close. The conversation creates the bridge here. And you're speaking in such a way as responding to people, giving an answer to them for those who ask. Peter talks about that. 1 Peter 3:15 calls us to be ready to give an account for the hope that is in you, which is still that same idea, that you're ready to speak into someone's life when they're asking. But there has to be something they would ask, something they would see. Responding to each individual. So it's personalized and customized. Now, when you think of the idea of sharing the gospel with people and speaking of Jesus, for a long time in my own walk with Christ, I had been schooled with the idea that you need to have all the answers. And unless you had all the answers, then you weren't really ready to speak with people. As a pastor, I took churches through this whole thing, and we'd do this big training type of thing so that all our people would have all the right answers. In fact, they almost trained to be a little bit manipulative, you know, so that you would guide them to the right questions so that you had the right answer. And yet, I found that people seldom were impressed with the answer. You notice that? And because many believers didn't think they had enough answer, they didn't want to engage in conversation. One of the guys that from the past, that is one of my kind of heroish type of guys that I'm fascinated with. I've read a bunch of stuff on this guy. Blaise Pascal. Know that name? Probably one of the smartest guys to ever walk on the earth. This amazing guy, inventor, philosopher, theologian. Just kind of had it all, and came to Christ. And one of the things that he set out to do was to create kind of an airtight defense of the gospel. One of those things where he had everything covered, and if anybody could have done it, it would have been him. So he set out, and this was back in the 1600s. So back away. But he started writing this big deal. It was called, at that point, it just went under the title of Pensis, which just means thoughts. In other words, he was putting it together. It's his rough drafts of all these things, and it's an amazing thing. He never did finish it, but he's going through it, and it's incredible. But he gets way down the road on this thing and discovers something, kind of in his own personal journey and interaction with people. And so he stops for a moment, or space of time, and he writes this little side thing, not much larger than a pamphlet. It's called The Art of Persuasion. And in it, he kind of almost mourns a bit, because here's a guy, he's smart. Man, he's one of these guys that, you know, you sit down with him and no matter where you're coming from, he can pull it apart and put it back together and he's got it. But in this, he describes the idea that that people seldom make decisions based on proof. It's an interesting thing. Kind of depressing if you're building something on proof. People seldom make decisions based on proof. So in fact, you can engage people in conversation and you can win the argument and not persuade them. Maybe you've found that to be true. I've done that. I'm kind of wired with a personality that I can do that. I can, if I let myself and my fallen nature take hold, I can make you feel pretty stupid. Now, I know others who can make me feel stupid, but this idea of I can just push a bunch of facts your way and we can do this thing and I can come out going, gotcha. But obviously no one's persuaded by that. If anything, they're turned off by it. So what he did was he wrote this thing out. One of the key lines in it, he says that for almost every person is almost always led to believe, not through proof, but through that which they find attractive. So almost every person finds themselves not making decisions based on proof, but upon that which they find attractive. So the idea that he was coming up with was this thing, is as we present the gospel, is it attractive? Is it something that I would look at and say, yes, that's exactly what I want. And as I look at my life, that's the way I want it to look in my life. And if not, we don't have anything. So it resorted his whole way of thinking in this. Now taking all of this here, let me come back to where I started. This text had a lot to do with informing me, and it wasn't the first time I had entered into this portion of Scripture before, but it became a big deal for me. So as I looked at my life back, you know, last month, and needed to make some decisions, I made three decisions on how I would course correct in this area. And I pitched them in terms of next year, I'm not going to let this happen again. You know, particularly the holiday time, I mean, all these things. Not going to happen to me. So here's what I decided. First of all, because of the holidays being so consumed with the idea of buying gifts and that kind of stuff, the way I'm going to address that is I'm going to start out every single day with the idea that my primary goal is to give a gift to Jesus. You know, something that I know will please Him. A sacrifice of some kind that I can bring to Him and say, this is for you. And that would balance things. Pretty cool idea, right? I liked it. Secondly, that I was going to make sure that there was some kind of biblical text, some portion of Scripture that was driving that space of time. Not just like a one morning devotion thing, but something that I was going to let run through that whole space of time, that I would allow that to define me, that text. So I wouldn't get off message, I wouldn't get off story. And then third, and this was kind of perhaps the biggest one for me, was that I was going to pre-think every situation I was going to be in. Now, not all the ones that I don't know about, but if I knew I was going to be with a group of people or in some kind of situation with certain individuals, that I wanted to start my day by pre-thinking that one and doing it in the form of prayer, inviting Jesus into it and looking at it and imagine what would conversation sound like that was gracious, seasoned with salt with that person. Because I found that if I didn't pre-think it, I probably wouldn't do it. It's just too easy for me to waltz into things and waltz out of things and then feel bad. But if I pre-think it, then I'm already predisposed to bring Jesus into it. And as I did that, I wasn't trying to think in terms of some way to jam the whole gospel in front of him. But what would gracious speech seasoned with salt sound like in that sitting? So that was great. I had all those plans. I said, okay, next year that's what I was going to do. It's easy to make plans for a year away. But as I did that, one of the convicting things was that, hey, this is the way you're supposed to live all the time, isn't it? And I needed to make that course correction of saying, hey, I need to start every day by saying, Jesus, I want to bring a sacrifice to you today. To somehow do something that I know will please you. And I can end the day by knowing it was done. I want to have some text that is always driving me, defining how I order myself in the day. Not just a devotional thought, but something that I'm allowing to pervade a whole space of time and shape me. So I stay on message. And then as I continue to go through the rest of the year, to be pre-thinking in those situations I'll know I'd be in. And they're always there. I mean, in the last month since I put this together, I don't know how many situations I've been in, but if I start my day pre-thinking it, I'm already discovering I'm much more predisposed to interact with people a certain way because I've already thought about what the conversation might sound like. And so I'm not surprised by my own voice when I do it. Just saying. God calls us to be this. To be those who engage with people with graceful encounters. And be the presence of Jesus wherever we are because he resides inside us. Let's pray together.